Welcome, BattleTech fans. This is Travis with special co-host, Mr. Tex himself, and you're watching the Renegade HPG podcast. My guest today is Sven Vanderplank. Sven joined the community of BattleTech content creators about a year ago and has since developed an extensive library of BattleTech lore. In this conversation, we're going to explore what that experience has been like for Sven, with Tex here using his own expertise as podcast host and lore master to help me out and pulling as much insight from our guests as possible. Sven, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
I'm more than happy to. It's great to be here.
Definitely. So looking at your channel, it looks like you've been kind of engaged on YouTube for several years with a lot of gameplay, but it was about a year ago that you really kind of dove into BattleTech. You know, I'm curious what the catalyst was that inspired you to kind of take this deep dive into the universe that we all know and love.
Yeah, so about a year and a half ago, Warhammer was going through a bit of a turbulent time. It's not a franchise I'm particularly invested in, but there was a lot of people kind of coming across from that side of the kind of tabletop hobby. And I, just as a one-off really, thought it would be a good idea to create like a 10-minute kind of intro to the BattleTech universe. And the reception to that was just really positive, and I decided to just keep rolling with it. And that's led to me covering a large part of the early history of the franchise.
Awesome. And is this a solo effort, or is there a little team behind you? You know, not including the collaborations that you've done.
Well, I was just about to say, yeah, we've just wrapped up the Star League Civil War series, which have been collaborating with some other people in the community, that channels that I've been enjoying and watching for many years, long before I started myself. But for the most part, it's just been myself working away on it. I've had a few kind of conversations behind the scenes, kind of getting feedback from people, but otherwise it's me doing all the editing and scripting and all that sorts.
And what kind of experience do you have personally, professionally, that's kind of, you know, lent to this endeavor? You know, are you in video editing? Is just this just a pure, you know, hobby, you know, side passion for you?
Yeah, it was very much just kind of a hobby, kind of a creative outlet. My work didn't really give me that kind of opportunity. So I had, like you were saying earlier, you know, I started the channel basically just to play some games, just an excuse to do that. But yeah, kind of as it evolved in ways I didn't anticipate at the time. I haven't got any kind of background in video editing or anything like that, so I've very much been just learning as I go along. I look back and I'm not really impressed with some of my earlier videos, but like I say, always trying to iterate on it and improve as I go along.
I empathize with that. I mean, I just finished editing a video with Brent last night, and I'm still not very impressed with what I do, but I always tell myself it's the content, not the appearance or aesthetic. But you know, in Texas, you were going for a while, weren't you, before you brought Mike on?
Well, the first 9 years were a solo experience, more or less. And it's kind of strange. I met Mike through a mutual friend, and we started doing some shitposty stuff because, like most YouTubers, you just start playing games and having fun with your friends and stuff like that. But after a while, you realize if you stay the same, well, let me back up. I would say you need to learn from Benjamin Franklin. When you stop changing, you are finished. When you finish changing, you are finished. When you stop evolving, when you stop trying to beat yesterday's man up to become today's man, you're done. And so I wanted to do a little bit more. And as that's gone along, I built a team. And it's as these things get more and more complex, you end up having to do more team-based stuff because it becomes something where it's insurmountable with the time you have. And over the time, it's kind of been interesting. At current, and I've talked about this a little bit on my podcast, and actually had some of my coworkers on the podcast. I work in the defense industry. I know a lot about the industrialization of warfare on a very, very high level. And what's kind of funny is as Tex Talks BattleTech has gone on, I've put more of that reel in there. And it's earned a lot of attention from various other people who work in the defense industry. I was speaking with Perun, who's a friend of mine. He's a big defense industry YouTube channel. And Prune was like, wow, you know, you put a lot of real in that. And I'm like, well, right. But it's one of those things where when you look at lore as it is, there's a lot of stuff that's hand wavium. You know, they're like, well, of course, all units have perfectly fine C3I systems. And you're like, yeah, that's never true. The only thing that's true in war is chaos. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. Mike Tyson said that. Yeah. So it's one of those things where I found that what I do evolves and where I bring it from evolves. And I find that injecting a lot more of your personal life experiences and things. And Sven, I've seen you do that with your work, and bravo, sir. Bravo. A lot of people think that, you know, in the BattleTech community, we don't watch each other's work, or we're all egocentric nutbags on various things. But your work is very good. And I'm very glad that you didn't try to copy or emulate anything I did. You charted your own way and you built it your own self. And you have all of my respect for that. And you obviously used a lot of things that come from your heart and your soul and your hard-won experience. And I think that that is all you need to do to make good video, is use everything life has given you, good and bad, every bit of hope and every grim disappointment and setback, every terrible, dark emotion you feel, you can put into words and you can speak them with gravitas that moves people, even though it's just silly, stompy robots.
Well, thank you very much for that, Tex. I think I said to you as much when we were last talking. There was a certain anxiety, trepidation about covering this last the Starlink Civil War that I've been doing, because it had already been done so well by the Black Planet Legion, and yeah, it was difficult to know how to approach it in a way that wasn't just rehashing the same old thing that people had heard before in a, let's be honest, less good way. So I was trying
Bullshit.
To find
you did a fine job. You did a fine job.
The well, way thank you. Thank you.
But here's the way I look at it. It's like a chili cook-off, right? Or a pie baking contest. Everybody there is going to bring a pretty good pie, and everyone's going to make it in their way. Even though pie is something that is universal and every country has pastry, there's 1,000 variations of pie and they can all be good. And I said years ago at the end of the American Civil War, I said, I want more people to make this stuff. I am but a very tired voice in the choir. Mm-hmm. And I want more people to get out there and make stuff. I don't care if they make or cover the same things the way I do. I want to see 1,000 lenses on things.
No, I'm just with you on that one. Yeah. I think it would be fantastic to, if we could just inspire more and more people to kind of take it up the hobby, and so to speak.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that creation, making shit, is the best thing you can do with any of those pent up, awful, terrible, feel bad emotions you have, every setback in your life. If you go and look at any jazz musician or any blues musician, you never saw they had a good childhood and everyone treated them well. You find misery, murder, setbacks, tragedy, and all of that comes out on stage and it moves people. The same thing with film.
The what inspired you, Sven, to go specifically toward the type of lore, the type of videos that you did? What was it that kind of was that hook for you, you know, to focus on that side of BattleTech, to kind of really zoom out and get this, you know, this, I want to say galaxy, but intersphere wide focus to draw from, rather than, you know, a lot of other people, you know, will do a faction or a mech or, you know, whatever it might be. You know, what was that driver for you that really kind of, you know, really kind of wet your palate in terms of diving into that aspect of lore?
Yeah, I'm really not sure when I made the decision to kind of start from the beginning and kind of go through it. Because at some point after the first few episodes, I kind of realized what I'd committed myself to. And I was like, oh my God, you know, this is too big a task to go through it all. But yeah, I don't know exactly what it was. There's a channel on YouTube, not BattleTech, but I'm particularly fond of and been watching for many years now, called Historia Civilis, and goes through a lot of ancient Roman history, has been more recently covering the kind of 18th century European politics or 19th century. And yeah, it has that same kind of grand scale overview of very kind of key events in history. And that's definitely kind of inspired my style, being probably the biggest influence in terms of what form my videos have taken. But yeah, like I said, truthfully, I don't remember exactly what it was that made me decide to, hey, let's go right back to the beginning and start the story there.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed it. You know, I've found, you know, I mean, I've made it through a fraction of your work, but I've found that, you know, one of my, you know, physical goals for myself is just log as many miles on the trail as I can this year. And it's perfect to kind of put on and just kind of listen as I go, you know, walking through the woods. And so, so you know, the format's great. I enjoy it. And I'm curious, you know, you've obviously had to read through a vast amount of material in order to get the content for these episodes. What stands out as kind of your favorite writers, you know, of BattleTech lore? Like, who do you think does it best in terms of kind of, you know?
You know, off the lore, I really should look into this, but I don't know. I couldn't name specific people who have written the source books I'm most fond of. I mean, I can talk at length about the novels I've read, but and I've definitely got my favorite authors there. But of the source books, I'd need to actually look that up and see if there were specific people who had behind the scenes had been contributing to some of my favorites.
Yeah, I only realized as, you know, I listened to you answer that, that it really is kind of ambiguous in the source books of where things come from. There's not too many that just have one writer.
There's certainly like a long list of contributors at the start of each source book.
Definitely.
But, you know, you have like the short stories at the beginning, and I couldn't name who's writing them, even in like my favorite kind of historicals or some of the older source books I'm particularly fond of. Yeah, it's unclear exactly who has contributed how much to the different books.
Interesting. Well, I mean, that leads well into my next question, which was, you know, what are kind of your favorite source books that you read? What are your kind of like top five recommendations for quality source books from the FASA to the CGL age of BattleTech for people to read?
Well, the CGL, it's anything bearing the historical name to it. So I've been just absolutely blown away with the quality of the historical series. So I read The Reunification War, the two volumes of The Liberation of Terror have been particularly good. I've also enjoyed reading the Brush Wars one, which is at a kind of further point in the timeline I've reached myself. They dropped the name historical for the First and Second Succession Wars books, but they're also excellent. I wish there was a little bit more art in those specifically, but otherwise the quality of the writing and the stories they tell are just as great. The older books I'm particularly fond of, of the classic ones, obviously, you have to mention the House books. They're so foundational. So much has been kind of drawn from them over the years as well. Really important. I really like the Galtor source book. It's great. And then a little bit later in the clan invasion, the Battle for Luthien was the next one, was kind of that level. Right now, I'm actually reading the Tukia, the original. I think it was 95 it came out.
Okay.
Which is a couple years after the actual battle that appeared in the novels at that point, but they kind of went back and kind of hashed out some of the details. I'm still only about a quarter of the way through that, but that seems to be of a similar kind of vein, and I'm enjoying that a fair bit. It's been a kind of personal project, BattleTech wise, for several years now, at least as long as I've been doing videos on it, to go through the entire catalog of source books from the very beginning and read every single one of them, skip over some of the rules, but to try and pick up through the lore exactly at which points kind of key figures are entering the stage, even if it's just a name drop that's later going to appear in a novel or something. And it's been quite interesting to see how it's evolved in that regard. Has kind of new mechs appear on the scene, but also major characters that started out just maybe a sentence or two in a source book that you know are going to play major parts further down the line.
Definitely. Tex, any that you want to add in? Any favorites on your side?
I would have to say, and much, much deference to your guys' opinion on this, but I'm a voracious reader of everything. But the problem is I have sometimes this issue, and you guys can tell me if you have the same or not, but my memory works like a patchwork quilt of experiences. Mm-hmm. So I'll be like, wait, that guy did this. Wait, that was the guy who did this. And I'll be like, what book was that in? And I will yeah. lose my mind trying to remember who wrote what. I would say the first books I read still stick with me. The Jade Falcon trilogy, very well written. I really liked those. And I remember as a kid, you go, wow, you know, this battle to, or this MechWarrior game is really cool. Wait, there's books? And you start reading those books and you're like, holy shit, this is deep. And, you know, as a kid, especially, because, you know, as a kid, everything's deep the first time you read it. You're like, you know, and then you go read stuff as an adult and you're like, eh. But
I had that experience. Yeah.
Well, that's fine. It's fine. I mean, it's rare you go back to anything and as the same magic. It's really impressive, though, when it still has it. That's why. Mm-hmm. You know, after being a BattleTech fan for a long time, I find that I can still go back and read the fluff and certainly appreciate the finer touches of things. Because as I go on in my life and I have more experiences, especially in my day job, I look back and I go, someone did their homework on this. Someone really gave some thought into systems that were being built back then. And this is a critique of them. Some of these things I can point out and I go, oh, cool. That's the MBT-70. That's the MBT-70 failure program. Oh, wow. That's making fun of Shalala. Oh, wow. That's making fun of, you know, various naval building programs. And I go, hot damn, this is really, really, really future-proof. Like, I've read some of that. The other thing that really still grasps me, like really grabs me in BattleTech, is it's one of those settings that is rule of cool that I don't mind. It's rare that I can sit there and smile at rule of cool and go, yeah, it's cool. Please don't ask any questions. But BattleTech is that rule of cool where it's perennially like 1983 in space. Mm-hmm. And everyone's got like massive, massive sideburns and smokes and doors. And they look like REO Speedwagon covers. Everyone just looks absolutely bonkers for no reason. You're like, is that an Afro samurai? And you're like, yes, he's killed 10,000 people on this planet. And you're like, man, that guy's baller. I want to read about that guy. That guy seems cool. And everyone is cool in BattleTech for various reasons. It's not so campy, except in a few places, but that's fine. Everything has their camp. Even Star Trek was chock full of it. And I love Star Trek. But I find the best part of the fiction is that you can very easily find a place to build and set a character. And it feels real, no matter where you are. You can go and say, my guy is this from this place and role play that. And it fits just fine. It's a setting where a lot is possible. And it has a lot of human elements, which is, I would say, more than anything, drags me in. I had a friend of mine who reached out and said that when he watched the Amer Civil War, he started alone and he finished it with his dad. And his dad never liked sci-fi. His dad is a guy who reads Tom Clancy novels all the time, which I think is sci-fi, but to each their own, right? Yeah. They're airport books. But he sits there and reads Tom Clancy novels and was never into this. But he overheard the Amer Civil War and he comes in and sits down and his dad sits down and he goes, God, what a drama. What battle is this? What war is this?
Awesome.
And my friend goes, it's fictional. This is a fictional tabletop setting. Now he and his dad play BattleTech. So when you see that, that means that I'm not trying to say that because I think I'm great. I don't. I am from dirt and I intend to return to it. But what I think it means is that if something is that special that allows somebody who is such an outsider and such a person who would never give that a second thought, and it grabs them and it makes them go, I want to be part of this universe too. That's very special.
It's interesting that resonates with another story I'd shared with Lauren that was relayed through Devin Ramsey, you know, where he had shared his mom never got BattleTech and didn't understand why he was, you know, spending so much time with it. And he shared Lauren's book Endgame with his mom and she read it. And after that, you know, she she understood, she appreciated it more. And so I think that comes from doing what you're passionate about and doing it well. And,
well, sure.
And that relays. And it'll capture anybody if you're just kind of, you know, going through the motions to make a video or do something and it's not the video you want. Like, you know, definitely kind of a tangent issue, but you know, I had done, when the Kickstarter stuff first arrived, I had done like a box opening video. And because I was really curious about how the sizes matched with the old miniatures. And so I was like, I'll put on video so people can kind of see how, you know, the new Marauder stacks with the old Marauder or the Direwolf. And it was like, my channel was young at the time and just blew up. And so I did another one. And then by the time a third one, I was like, you know what? I fucking can't stand, you know, box opening videos. You know, I just did it because I was curious about this one thing. I wanted to share it. And so, you know, I think, and then went back to, you know, the things I was passionate about. And I think that a lot of people kind of get seduced by, content creators get seduced by that, that view count or that interaction.
Oh, God,
kind
yeah.
of deviate yeah. from what they are passionate about instead of being patient and staying the course. And I think that, you know, I've even seen it with you, Sven, because there was a lot of videos that you were putting out before it really, you know, hit. Before, you know, the people really started taking notice, you know, and obviously I, you know, it's just coming from a third person, but, you know, I'm guessing from you as a first person that you can track kind of where that inflection point happened, you know, with your following, with the interest. And so, and I think that's, there's no way to create that. You just keep trucking and eventually if they find you. You know,
well, so. It
is what it is. I was going to say, but
yeah, that's what I was going to say. It is what it is. It's like, yeah.
You mentioned earlier, Travis, that when I started, I was just playing a bunch of games. And that was really because, without going into the whole story, at one point in my life, you know, I used to play a lot of video games and then decided to go down the career path of learning how to make them myself. And it just sucked all the enjoyment out of it. Mm. And I think from about 2012 onwards, didn't pick up a single game and just had no interest in it. And when I started the channel, it was really an excuse for me to just play some again for the first time in best part of a decade. And it didn't matter that no one was watching at the time. It was basically, that's all it was, just try and get back into a hobby that I'd fallen out of love with. But yeah, I mean, it's changed now. And so, yeah, you do think about a little bit. You do see what's happening behind the scenes in terms of what gets traction. But I've found something that I really enjoy making now, making these videos. And it's nice now as well that they have, that other people are seeing them and seeing such a positive reaction to them as well, or reception.
I think that really drives it, is it's mm-hmm. like, I absolutely agree. I apologies for interrupting earlier. I was going to say it is what it is. You and I are kind of the same thing where we realize that ships are safe in harbor, but that's not what ships are for. And so as we go out onto the waters, we find out sometimes the sails don't catch the wind all that great. And sometimes things don't go as well as you wish, or sometimes things land wrong or the wrong time of year, or something happens in your life that is so traumatic or so fucked up that it destroys your ability to enjoy anything. And it's so critically important to have an outlet. And it's why my team and I have this policy of like, we put everything we have, money, time, certainly effort, we work for so very little just to push hard, because this is something that we all enjoy doing, regardless of how well we feel, regardless of how much we think about ourselves, regardless of our sense of permanence in this world. I've told people many times I'm just another voice in the choir, and I find that there's plenty of people who share that mindset because it is easier to sing with others. And as you go on and build, the thing that is nourishing to the soul is not clicks or views or any form of social relevance or credit, but those small stories that people share with you about, I was having a bad fucking day.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And your video helped me through. And when you hear that enough and you find that other people have been picked up by that, you go, you know what? I'm going to make another one. And you just keep going and you forget all the times you got punched in the face and fell down the stairs. You go, well, I can still walk and I can drag myself if I can. And I got friends who will pick me up and carry me. But when you realize you have that drive in you, and that drive is something that other people can see and emulate and go build their own beautiful things. I get nice little messages from people like my friend Tuck Davion at Battlebound. And, you know, Tuck is one of those people that during COVID went out and just said, I'm going to drive around and meet all of the people and play in the local game stores and show people how BattleTech is. And you find people who are inspired and continually feedback and give positive energy and say, you know, I'm from a different walk of the woods. I'm from a different background than you. And I can bond with my friends and loved ones over the thing I love over this. And you realize, well, shit, okay, I have to make another one. And you have to keep going and going and going. And that is where creation comes from. It's so very important. Like you say, you were working in the game industry and you found out how very quickly the magic is gone when you see how the magic tricks are performed. Every industry is like that. You don't want to eat beef if you work in a butchery shop. Well, you probably do. I would. I love beef. But you know what I mean. It's one of those things where if you see how the sausage is made, a lot drains out of you. And you need that sense of drive and importance. And if you can find something that uplifts, or hell, in our clumsy efforts, raises charity in the same process, it's empowering like nothing else. Because other people can have the million plus subscribers and the merch and all that stuff. And that's fine. That is fine. No sin against them. But if you can uplift people and pluck them out of dark places by just shitposting your ass off, I think that's a blessing.
No, I'm with you on that one. And the comments that stick with you the most are those people who are, you know, let's say I was going through a really tough time. And this was a welcome distraction for an hour or two. And that really does give you that drive to keep going, more so than a million views ever would.
Absolutely.
It's those few individuals that you really did something.
Absolutely. Hands fucking down. My grandfather said, do a goddamn good job for 10 people and not a shit job for a million. And I think that that stands true. You need to go through life like you are trying to do your very best every day. And if you do that honestly and earnestly, you will find people who appreciate that in an era of quick clicks, quick views, and fame. Because fame is a four-letter word unless you use it well. Mr. Rogers said that, and I think he's a bit wiser than all of us put together.
To bring some levity in it, you guys have read a lot of lore. Give me kind of what you're the most kind of eye-rolling, grunt-inducing type of
okay,
you've come across.
Yeah, Sven, you start us off before I have a hand.
I wish I could remember the name. It's from House Kili de Source book or House book, and it was some
like the original, the original,
the original one, I think 87. It was some former coordinator who had retired, and then in a one sentence summary of their life was they died aged 111 in a water skiing accident.
What?
Yeah, and like you just imagine that, and you're like, what was going on there? Like, you know. Well, yeah, mind runs rampant.
The accident was that they tried to water ski. So.
He was, you know, Grandpa was at the top of the pyramid, and you know, he really wanted to do the water thing, and you know, the ramp came up, and he said, "Watch this shit," and you know, it happened, and it was very, very honorable. No more questions.
I've got another great one from a recent Vlada Kerensky book. I'll try and find it. Tex, you can go ahead and give your answer to that.
All right. My favorite is there's a lot of it's in vehicles. I am but a cog. I am but a guy in the defense industry, and my colleagues unfortunately or fortunately, very much appreciate TexTalk's BattleTech. And so they give me all sorts of fun pointers on stuff I'd forgotten about and scream about. So every so often I'll have a message from one of them. They're like, hey, I was reading Sarna. Check this shit out. And the problem is that you start to see laid bare the sins of the military-industrial complex. By the way, anyone out there who's playing bingo for text appearances, military-industrial complex has now been said twice in the same paragraph, so go ahead and do your double shot, but please drink some water. When you start to see some of the sins laid bare, where it's like, here's a vehicle that was intended to do all of the things. And then you just scream because you've seen that in real life. And you realize it's really hard to make something that's like 60 tons amphibious. You realize that, you know, some of this stuff certainly reads like copy from the MIC. Mm. Where they're like, this is the vehicle that can replace 50 other vehicles. And you're like, no. No, it can't. It will break. It will break, and the industrial chain will cripple it. And you find a lot of hopeful stuff in there. My favorite bully boy in all of the lore is the Buhalan Military Systems Rotunda, which I have shit on already with Star League Auto, where it's four doors for more whores. It's a 20-ton vehicle, which in the real world, that's, you know, it's light scout or certainly heavier end of MRAP territory. But it's a car. It has no ground clearance. It's just
It's a car. It's got like two stories in it. It's crazy if you read the description of it.
It's a camper on the inside. It's got sleeping and cooking and a fusion engine and a large laser and, you know, SRMs and all that stuff. And I absolutely just scream at it because I can only imagine being on a battlefield and you're sitting there watching the front and you're listening to comms and you hear like, okay, mech transiting in my sector, north to south, looks like a 25 tonner based on seismic sensors. Maybe, you know, and you're calling stuff in as it comes along and you're like, okay, what do I use my artillery assets on? What do I hold back? I don't want to uncase my guns until I have to. And then I just imagine it getting up channeled where they're like, we have a fucking car. And you're going, what? Looks like a four door saloon. It has wood paneling on the side and it's stuck in a trench. It is stuck. The guy stuck the car. And you go, yeah, I guess I'll send a guy out there with a stick to kill him. Like, it is just absolutely bonkers. But again, there are plenty of real life products that echo this where you just scream and go, why? And that's something that I love about BattleTech. Again, there's crazy stuff in the lore, but you have to keep in mind, like, okay, a guy dies at 111 water skiing. One, BattleTech, rich people from industrially advanced countries have a much longer lifespan. You know, Kerensky was commanding at a very old age. A lot of people have a very advanced lifespan with a lot of life still left in them. But you have to keep in mind, historically, I believe it was Alexander II of Greece died by monkey bite. People die of dumb shit all the time. And if you don't believe me, go speak with a paramedic. They will tell you that, well, how did this guy die? Well, he was trying to fry a turkey over a carpet. And you will find all of these terrible disasters happen because somebody was just kind of dumb and kind of felt like they knew what they were doing. I like those, even though they're silly and eye rolling. You're like, surely that would never happen. And then you realize history is full of that, of things that happened all the time.
We, Sven, you're up with your Blood of Kerensky. Did you find it?
Yeah, it's not so much lore. It was just something you said, something that made you roll your eyes. And it was a specific kind of excerpt from the third Blood of Kerensky book, which coincidentally does have a rotunda in it. In fact, I think it actually gets some airtime as it enters the compound. So I don't know how they pulled that one off. It might even go cartwheeling through the air.
Yeah. If you've ever seen the making of any film where they do like jumps with cars, it's really fucking cool. And you go, whoa, that's metal. And then you see it land and you see like the wheels and shocks go through the hood and the whole thing bends like a banana. And you're like, oh, that wasn't cool at all.
saw a video last week. It was a school bus jumping a ramp over like 30 motorcycles. And yeah, it was amazing. You can expect it when it cleared the jump. You can expect, you know, whatever happened to the bus when it actually
he made it all the way to the crash is what you mean.
Yes. Yeah. He did. He survived. All right. But yes, that bus, it did not land smoothly. It did not Dukes of Hazzard its way over those motorcycles.
Know that the Dukes of Hazzard went through 20 to 25 cars this season?
A season?
Oh my God. Yeah. That's awesome. It's just one of those things where I'm not sure if you've ever driven an old Charger. They look and sound like hot sex, but you get in them and you're like, man, I'm doing 70 miles an hour. This engine sounds great. I'm going to apply the brakes. Why am I not stopping? And the brakes get hotter and hotter and hotter, and the car don't slow so much. And you realize this is a death trap.
Good old drum brakes.
Good times. Man, little Travis was a huge Dukes of Hazzard fan. So what do you have in mind coming forward, Sven? Like what's are you just gonna keep kind of powering through the timeline?
That's the plan. Keep going. A few people have asked me to cover specific points in the timeline, but I'm not thinking of doing it anything other than linearly. So next up is First Succession War. I've already completed the first couple episodes of that. It's quite interesting it's changed my kind of opinions on things. Going through this series, my feelings towards certain aspects of the lore have changed repeatedly. So, you know, everyone talks about the Star League text, you know this well, and characters in universe, we're all looking back at it with rose-tinted glasses.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I've tried to continually remind people is I write from the perspective of a character at a certain point in history. And a lot of the Star League Civil War, he discusses that this was a very hopeful but hopeless act. And a lot of these people were attritioned personally by the decisions they made. And ultimately, everyone paid a price, and it's a very human story. In my more recent work, as I go back, I have to remind people there's a flip side of the coin. The Star League of the Reunification War is not the same Star League as the AmeriCivil War. A lot of things change, and one leads into the other. There are changes of doctrine and policy. There are very different changes in mission and projection power, and all of that lesson has to be learned in the reunification. By the way, your reunification series is fantastic. I heavily recommend it to anybody who asks. People say, Tex, when are you going to do the reunification? I'm like, go watch Spin. And I want them to know that. Like, again, we're all voices in the choir, and I want people to know that, hey, please go watch his stuff. And I think that you've covered that very well. And I think that you absolutely are right to do that linearly. Unfortunately, I fucked myself on that, and I'm going to have to go back and cover things out of order, but I'm a bit haphazard. So I think my fans are used to it.
I think people in the community are much more aware these days of the Star League was pretty abhorrent in what they were doing, like completely imperialist, horrific war crimes committed by them in the name of the greater good, of course.
But well, hey, it's not war crimes the first time. Ares suggestions.
I'm working through the reunification episode now. And yeah, my share the same. It's brutal. It's people's desire for power and control. And I have a question later that'll kind of follow up on that. But
going back to what I was saying, though, about people looking back at it with rose-tinted goggles, like a lot of people in universe in the 31st century, they're kind of oblivious to some of those darker aspects of it. And this ties into what I'm going through now with the First Succession War, where you start to read about what happened, what went down in those 35 years. And you think, Jesus Christ, no wonder people look back on it as this kind of utopia, because everything that followed was so much worse in every way. And now my opinion is like shifting back is like, you know what? The Star League, for all its crimes, wasn't so bad, because as soon as it collapsed, things really went to hell.
I absolutely agree with you on that. And I think that's, again, another great human element of Battletech is you can find your lens shifts on things as you must consider the lens in which it is viewed. Because if you were in the second or third succession war and you go, I remember back when warships were real. I remember back when, you know, the standard of living was better. Think about the poem Ozymandias. Look upon my works, ye mighty, in despair. That is present in Star League. When you are in any intersphere world of high technology, you see the markers and remnants of this once mighty empire. And you wonder, what were these empire builders like? And so you have to ask yourself as well, what survives? Like, what survives forward? Are people only lauding the achievements? Are people not? And that's a great challenging aspect of bias and lens, because I think anyone who grew up in the universe, anyone who was an in-universe point of view, would certainly have their lens colored, most certainly by where they grew up, how hard they grew up, and what their experiences were. And if you're a big house military, for instance, you're probably going to think the Star League was a bunch of overreaching assholes, and that it was only just and proper that the great houses move back up to the forefront of establishing the rightful dominance over affairs. But then if you're, say, working for a certain telecoms company, you're going to have a bigger picture of things, and you're going to go, right, but Star League kept these four wars from happening. And they kept the peace, even if a flawed peace, even if through manifest hypocrisy, they kept the peace. And so you ask yourself, which system is better? That's a more interesting debate. And so you find that things could be worse is frequently said of most settings. And in Battletech, it's vacillated between worse and holy shit, what is that? And it just keeps going back and forth like a very cursed metronome.
Yeah, for all that's said about humanity, civilization and decay, kind of end of the Third Succession War era, that compared to what came before it and what would follow not much longer afterwards, you know, people didn't know how good they had it then, because once shit really starts to go down, it's not good. And before long, yeah, those few years of industrial decay probably look back on quite fondly, I imagine.
Well, it's one of those things you also realize that there are two viewpoints to history, and this is kind of inevitable with generationalism, where you find viewpoint A is looking back and going, man, those were the good old days. But viewpoint B is realizing when you're in the good old days, when you were alive in the good old days, you didn't think they were all that good. You're like, man, things could be better. They could also be worse. Time keeps changing. The world keeps changing. And that's another reason I love Battletech, is that there is a state of flux in things. Sure, there are some anchor points. Sure, the great houses and great noble powers are fairly well entrenched. That's feudalism. That happens. Feudalism in Europe lasted a good long while. Interspace feudalism with certain bottlenecks and HPG and everything cementing it. Yeah. Tradition as well cements that for generations upon generations, especially when you have a bunch of big sticks to keep people in place. But I find that when you look at the state of Battletech history, certainly, as you say, by the decay and ruin of the Third Succession Wars, where everyone else has basically got pool noodles to attack each other with because they've expended all of their vast strategic power. And now it's like, well, it's permanent brush war time, because that's all you can do. You can't dump truck assets in the enemy's backfield anymore. You have to just continually grind your enemy down in a permanent war of attrition. And people look back and wonder and go, remember when we could just glass planets? That was sure great. And you're like, good God, who are these techno-barbarians?
Yeah, I'm struck, you know, listening to your episodes, Sven, and when you're talking about the size of each division or units of just how it compares to kind of the inner sphere, the whole now, you know, how I think a small peripheral nation was much bigger than a house state, you know, is 300 years later.
Yeah. I think there is actually some misconception on exactly like, how do I phrase this? I think a lot of people think the lowest point was kind of 3025 era. It was only after the kind of Helm memory core comes into the scene that things start picking up. But really, it's throughout the whole Third Succession War, the House militaries are slowly kind of getting back towards that point. And the real low point where everything is just in ruins is kind of end of the Second Succession War. And that's when there's just nothing left. I mean, they've fought themselves to exhaustion just twice now. And it is just, everything is in ruins. You've got units completely wiped out. What few people are still standing there, maybe at like 10% operational strength. And the Third Succession War, people, obviously all the industry, the complex machinery needed to make the real advanced stuff is long gone. But they've slowly been kind of reestablishing themselves, setting up that kind of foundational strength. And that kind of leads into what comes later. So I think I see every now and again people bring up the point of, suddenly Fourth Succession War, and especially Clan Invasion era, suddenly they've got all these numbers running around that's, came out of nowhere. But really, I think if you look at the kind of the numbers that they're talking about in the original House books for kind of 3025 era, there's a lot more at play than I think people realize.
What, Sven, would you like to see realized in a new source book? Like, what are kind of like some prime topics or errors that you think, CGL should take a look at for kind of upcoming publications?
Truthfully, I don't have a good answer for that, because CGL, which I think is a very good decision on their part, is moving things forwards. And I am very much excited to read through all the era. I should make clear, I'm lagging a long way behind. My knowledge extends up to about 3053 at this point. So there's so much I need to catch up on. And I like the way that they went back and did the retrospectives, those historical books, Reunification War, because they're all kind of set post-Jihad era. They start with little excerpts of, characters from that era looking back 300-400 years at these events. So I don't really know if there's a good point in history for them to go back and go through in greater detail. I mean, they could always do more on the Age of War or Third Succession War, especially that kind of first 150 years, not too fleshed out. But I think they're right in continuing things. And so because that's beyond where I'm familiar with in the timeline, I don't have a good answer for what they should do next in that regard.
Next, any suggestions?
I'm one of those people that could read all day, every day, if I had the time. And I'm just glad to kind of follow my whims. So I do have a lot of whimsy. Like when we did the Charger episode, I knew a lot of people didn't understand why I did the Charger, because it is a much maligned mech. A lot of people say it's the worst thing ever. And that's fine. A lot of those people also have an experience of that mech based purely on MechWarrior Online, where throwing hands at people is just verboten. So a lot of people don't understand that I kind of write from a very personal place. The Charger was really a love letter to a dead friend of mine, who was somebody who was very deeply unappreciated by life and by his family and his friends. And he was somebody who was put in a very unfortunately untenable position. And he was somebody who worked their ass off. And despite being imperfect, despite being second, if not 10th best, and despite being, never equipped for the task at hand, always rose to the challenge. He was one of those people that never gave up, and he outlasted so many things that should have destroyed him. And I wrote that from a very personal place, and I don't expect most people to ever understand or appreciate that, but those tones are in that. And where I intend to go next, I cannot say. I've never really been a linear person with history either, much like most of my topics. I tend to follow along with whatever's available. And so writing from personal places I kind of think gives me the appreciation that whatever they write next, wherever they take it, is fine enough. So long as they are drawing from those same deep wells, so long as they are writing with that same care and consideration, regardless of what people say is popular or unpopular, I wish for them to continue building with those same bricks that can elicit those same responses and callbacks.
Ben, what's, drawn on your best time at reading, what is, do you have a favorite kind of unsolved mystery in BattleTech? And if you do you, what are your own kind of conspiracy theories about it?
In the last episode I released, talked a little bit about kind of surviving Cameron Ayres at the end. And I've made frequent use of Sarna to glean a lot of knowledge throughout my time working on these videos. And very helpfully, they kind of link the different source books that they've drawn from and are included in the articles. So I think at some point I decided that I was going to cover, the story of the Trippets and, it escaping out to the periphery, supposedly with Cameron Ayr on board. And as I've always tried to do, try to write my stuff based off the actual source books and not just somebody else's interpretation of it. And so I kind of went looking for the story, followed those kind of links, and was really kind of surprised by what I found in terms of it went against the narrative that I've heard a lot of people kind of say over the years. So, I mean, without how long have I got here to go into the whole mystery?
Go into it, because that's still my favorite text video. So you're hitting the
Okay. So Tex, you've got a whole video on the Trippets, don't you? Trippets.
Yeah, I do. And I love conspiracy theories. So don't take my silence as judgment. This is me getting out my yarn and thumbtacks and going, no, please. I'll connect these dots as well.
Okay. So I'm going to contradict or go against what I think you were saying in your own video here. And I have had quite a few comments of people saying that I was in the wrong here. So, take this with a grain of salt. This is my interpretation of facts as I read them. Most of the story. Okay. So let's set the background here. So Richard Cameron, last First Lord of the Starling before Stefano Maris shoots him in the head. He has a daughter, Amanda, and she's killed shortly after Maris takes over. Supposedly, so as the conspiracy theory goes, he had a twin, or Amanda had a twin named Ian. And Ian was kept secret and smuggled off Terra out into the periphery where Kerensky was fighting his against the periphery uprising at that point in time. And Kerensky kept them hidden, took them with him on his exodus, or they're somewhere else out there in the periphery just waiting to return and reestablish the Cameron line. Most of that story, I mean, it's pieced together from a few sentences, snippets, dotted through many older books, but then kind of gathered together in one Jihad era book. I think it's Jihad Conspiracies. And supposedly, the diary of Hanni Schmidt of the Royal Black Watch, she wrote about a plan to smuggle away a Cameron off planet. And alongside these diary excerpts in the source book are the writings of whoever, that each source book is written by an in-universe character. That might be Comstar, might be Wolfnet, or whoever. And so you've got this character in the Jihad era giving her interpretation of what's written in the diary pages. Now, those Jihad era source books are written to contain contradictions and errors. And, you can point to several other things in that source book that turned out to be false. And I believe this story that comes from this source book about the surviving Cameron Ayr, this twin that escaped, is an error. It's based off that Jihad era character failed or mistaken interpretation of the diary pages. So what I think actually happened was Hanny Schmidt had a plan to smuggle Richard Cameron, the First Lord himself, away and replace Richard Cameron with a body double. There's so many layers to this. Took me a long time just to write it out back when I was making the video. So I'm struggling to remember the whole thing off the top of my head. But yeah, I think I've seen a lot of people over the years repeat this, that there is a surviving Cameron heir. And I think it's all the more tragic if that turns out that no, there never was. There never was this hope in the first place that they were just wiped out.
I absolutely support your thesis. Anyone who says you're wrong or that I'm right doesn't know. And the reason is that this is one of those things where all we can do is admit that we are picking a part of history that is by its basis suggestion and guesswork. And that's what's great, is it's a definite overlap to reality, where you look at, like, for example, the rumors of Anastasia as the last of the Romanovs. That persisted well past any truth showing, no, they were all shot. It doesn't matter. People love telling these stories. And I absolutely agree with your assessment of things. I think that I put a little bit of a spin on it, using just some suggestions that this is an idea that might have happened, but nobody really knows, because as soon as somebody came to try to salvage the thing, people blew it up and erased all history that could absolutely prove it. And that's why I love some of these jihad books, because it is a lot of misinformation. It's a lot of rumor. And this is the sort of stuff you see in the aftermath of a collapsed government, especially one that big. There are people who are planning misinformation, counterintelligence, little snippets of stories they heard or overheard. And it's kind of like a tall tale. There's a grain of truth, perhaps, in everything in this story, but contingency plans are not contingency reality. I agree with you. And I love to stoke it as a mystery. It's one of those things where, like the Minnesota tribe, mm-hmm. you just go, well, what happened to them? Well, they're out there, maybe. And people will counter that and go, you can't hide an army. An army can't just disappear somewhere. And I'm like, actually, there were some Republic of China military units that, after the Chinese Civil War, fled into the Golden Triangle and set up the basis of the international heroin trade. Yes, you can hide an army. Yes, armies can go to ground and go native and use their skills in other ways. This stuff happens throughout history. So I love those overlaps. But I think your thesis is completely fair and completely reasonable. But I also love that BattleTech allows us to have these debates over what might have been or what could have been, and stuff we cannot know for certain, because there are so many missing pieces, or the sources themselves are by default sketchy.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think what other kind of great mysteries there are in the universe. I mean, who killed Simon Cameron is obviously one of them. And tried to address that at the start of the Star League series I did, or the Civil War series I did. Snowfire, who killed coordinator of the Draconis Combine during the Second Succession War. I'm kind of going in down into the weeds here. But supposedly a Lyran agent, probably actually was Free World's plant, trying to impersonate a Lyran agent, or at least a double agent who was working for both of them. And what other mysteries are there? I'm trying to think.
Well, there's plenty of small mysteries. Like, there's a lot of little cool ghost stories in BattleTech, like the Black Marauder, there's also the lost battleship of Merope, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
There's all sorts of little things. And I like that the setting has these, because these feel like spacer tales you'd hear at a bar, where some old burnout looking like Tom Waits is like, hey, man, let me tell you a story about this thing I saw. And you're like, sure, whatever. But there's
Think that so many of those stories are just complete fabrications. It's not even based on anything. It's just, you know, came out of someone's imagination. There was no mystery there. Yeah.
Or it was a deathbed confession uttered by somebody. And then the person who overheard that didn't have enough context to really make sense of it, and added in their own very limited reasoning. And then that story gets photocopied 100 times, and it's a game of telephone. So you can't tell where the story started, You can't tell what's real and what's fake. And you can't tell at what point more was added to the story or essential parts were just carved off and left on the trimming floor.
Yeah. I mean, that leads back into what I was saying about that Jihad Conspiracies book. The author of the book, the universe character that wrote it, she's the one that presents the twin theory. You know, nothing that Hanny Schmidt has said in her writing, in her diary pages, ever mentions the twins. She mentions multiple Camerons, and she mentions somebody by the name of Ian. But it's all somebody else without the full picture interpreting it and presenting it as fact.
Sure.
Like you're saying, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So taking that, I want to kind of, you know, talk to you guys as if, you know, questioning about the Inner Sphere, you know, let's kind of just dive into the Lore Master side and try to learn a little bit. I'm curious what your insights are into the history and status of AI in the Inner Sphere. And I was interested because I hadn't really thought about it much until your last video. I was listening to your spin about how, you know, AI was really kind of put to rest after the liberation of
Terra. I mean,
I was struck by the parallel of like Dune, you know, and how, you know, AI is banned in Dune and
Butlerian Jihad and the Orange Catholic Bible. Yeah fantastic call over. Yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of wanted to draw on you guys to give us a little kind of mini episode here and education on the history and status of AI in the Inner Sphere.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a taboo topic in the universe. I mean, directly responsible for the deaths of so many. This supposedly this great shield that was going to protect us all ended up leading to, you know, some of the most horrendous loss of life during that war. So I don't really know how many more times later in the series that the great houses have kind of gone down that path of research. But yeah, I mean, Tex, maybe you can speak more on it.
As AI is envisioned, at least Star League's conception of it, at their height, at their zenith, you find this group at its absolute apex of achievement, and they build this AI system, which has very lethal capabilities, but is still very limited. And while it's good, it's not good enough. And so everyone has that lesson in hand. Now, you have, by the end of the Second Succession War, by the Battle of Hesperus, the last of the warships known, which isn't really the true last of the warships, but the last of the warships known are eradicated from Inner Sphere history. There's still a few here and there, but I won't get into that. You end up with all of the vertical integration to replace the prime strategic force projection, Leviathan force, Hobbesian force, is gone. There's no ability to make any more anytime soon. You have to then go back through the industrial base and slowly start climbing back up that ladder. It's like getting knocked down Tex and Civ. You sit there and go, shit, well, I can't build all these components anymore. So by the time of the clan invasion, you find that, yeah, there's a handful of warships left. In post-clan invasion, you see people start making warships again. It takes that long for people to believe in warships as a viable strategic possibility as part of a normal part of military operations and military affairs. And it was presumed that warships had been around a very long time, at least based on the history we have, and presuming it's not propaganda or lying. But we presume warships were around for centuries before someone started dabbling with AI and used a whole Inner Sphere worth of resources to make it a reality in a handful of locations. This means that the threshold to achieve this again, especially if they're starting from scratch or the ashes of textbooks, would require the same amount of investiture and resources. To protect what worlds? Well, the old Star League said, we're going to defend the core worlds of humanity. We're going to defend the hegemony, more or less. But everything else can kind of go, you know, McFuck itself. But when it comes down to the whole of the Inner Sphere again uniting for any sensible purpose, what worlds would you defend? You would have to have everyone's absolute buy-in and compliance to do this again. And so it becomes this thing that is just incredibly expensive for a limited niche gain. Sure, you could defend a handful of worlds with this very lethal weapon system, but it's a lethal weapon system that requires you to build a bunch of very advanced things and then kind of make sure and hope that your opposition, your peer state, doesn't keep up with the Joneses by building something to counter it from the very beginning, because they have those same lessons. This is called Romanization. When you are the Roman Empire and you build up all of these doctrines, tactics, and tools, the more you fight and clash with your enemy, the more of these tools and tactics they learn from and learn how to counter or build their own similar and complementary tools and tactics so they can even the playing field, or they start getting into what we like to call an irregular strategic dilemma, which is where if you can't build that stuff, how do you hard counter it? Well, these are incredibly expensive systems that require a lot of time and a lot of talent to build and generations of knowledge. So any great house doing this is going to say, well, I can build this thing, but it didn't save Star League, did it? And then they sit back and go, huh. So the threat threshold of a gamble like that has to escalate far beyond what their normal customary forces can handle, which is a lot of shit. And it would take generations of effort to achieve, even with everyone playing fair, which they won't. It's why the second Star League lasts as long as a fart in the shower. It doesn't last very long. It's one of those things that is a brief blip. Unifying forces in the setting are rare and almost undermined from the very instant they are conceptualized. So I think that you are going to end up with AI being something that is perennially a relic of yesteryear. It's going to be one of those things that people marveled at. Again, look upon my works, ye mighty, in despair. It is all the finest achievement of ruin, and it doesn't inspire people to follow that road.
Yeah, everything you were saying about the AI there is a parallel to the exact reason that the warships were just not part of the story for however many centuries. It wasn't so much that they had completely, you know, lost that knowledge. It was that they had to build all that manufacturing base from scratch after it had all been blown to oblivion. And they knew that just doing that would necessitate their rivals doing the same thing. And it was like opening Pandora's box. If you build one warship, everyone else is going to build their own warships. And so it was almost like it was better not even going down that path because there was going to be no significant gain made. If you have something that powerful and, you know, if everyone has zero, it's all fine. But as soon as somebody has one, they've got to have, you know, the equivalent on their side as well. So I don't think the desire is even there to go down the path of AI. I would say, though, that there are rudimentary AI, gets brought up every now and again. I think in some of the older source books, they talk about kind of training scenarios where they've got AI and little robots or what have you. Nothing advanced, nothing that's going to imitate human life or anything. But it does exist kind of in the background, but nothing that even approaches, you know, what was supposedly available to the Star League.
Well, yeah. Right. And it's one of those things of like Star League possessed what I believe they're terming now as strong AI, capable of independent decisions and executing them in a very efficient manner. The problem is that like in AI is a very generic term. There are people all over the internet now who are like, this is AI. And I'm like, ChatGPT, the thing that can just like copy Reddit? Or are you talking about the thing that makes word salad that is sometimes amusing? Or are you talking about the thing that can make art so long as that art has enormous boobs? Like, yeah, these are tools, but they're not really smart. They're not discerning. The human is still in the decision loop steering these things. And so I think that there's always a utility of smarter tools. There's always utility in training tools that require a computer to make advanced calculations and change based on human input. And certainly I would estimate some very weak AI systems being present in neurohelmet and man-machine interfaces just to make sense of you know, a person's capability of thought and natural sense of balance and many other, you know, feedback loops requiring something with a bit of processing power and the ability to make heuristic leaps in logic and decisions. And I think that that goes a very, very, very long way. But when you talk about smart AI, something that could drive a strategic level decision, something that could determine the outcome of a war, I think the great houses don't trust each other. Why would they trust a fucking robot?
I think this always gets me too, is just things get lost in the common use of terms. And so, you know, when my default when I hear AI is to think AGI, you know, and so when people are talking about AI, I'm just like, that's more of a virtual intelligence, you know, limited virtual intelligence than AI. And I mean, I have that with other things that people use. One of my pet peeves is when people say theory, you know, in common tongue, and they really mean hypothesis, and you have to kind of go through and tell which
I one know
to, what are they talking about, a theory or a hypothesis? And I catch myself doing the same thing from time to time, and I kick myself every time I say theory when I mean hypothesis. But I see that with AI, and unfortunately I feel like, you know, certainly in our modern time, I think that it dulls people's appreciation for dangers of what an AGI is when you assign AI to all these, just like you said, these tools that aren't what the big naysayers are on the dangers of true artificial intelligence. But I'm curious if that had popped up in other places in the BattleTech universe, which is why I'd ask, because it seems, and I'm aware of the Butlerian Jihad and General Dorr Dune lore, but I have not dove into it myself, and so I don't know much about it, but my assumption is that was an AGI, not just AI.
Oh yeah, that is definitely smart thinking machine. Thou shall not make a machine the likeness of a human mind. It's one of those things where you find techno-Luddites who more or less push things back and require alternatives to folding space and everything else to take place, which is fantastic. I fucking love Dune. It's probably my favorite sci-fi series. But when you start looking at the idea of smart tools, you have to ask yourself, how really smart was this AI? Because the natural point of contesting an enemy is certainly not around the orbit of the planet you're defending. The smart place of contesting the enemy with a navy is far the fuck away from your shores. It's fighting the enemy before they get to them. These things acted like a pack of smart dogs. They roamed around their points, but they really weren't capable of starting to go, this is a diversion. They couldn't make decisions that a human being would go, this is a feint. Where's the rest of the fleet? Humans will know when something's a trap. Humans are paranoid. Humans are very good at strategic decision-making. That's why wars frequently employ the smartest and the most, you know, broken down of individuals, because they have this ability to see chains of events and see cause and effect, and they can perceive things in a different way. A robot only knows how to make weighted decisions, at least with our current concept of AI. It only knows what you've shown it. That's why humans are still involved to make cars for the most part. Turns out a human can look at a door and goes, that's not straight. But a robot can go, all the laser points lined up, so that's perfect.
So taking kind of a next step there into your lore, one thing that struck me, Sven, was as you're talking about the theater of war, you're using all names for modern countries. And one of the things that I am curious about as a fan of BattleTech is what does Terra look like? What has been the history of Terra over these thousand years? And I'm curious of, have you read true things behind those countries enduring over that time? Or do you think that was just an artifact of the creators just using that as familiar points to kind of communicate and talk about those regions on Terra? Is there truly Spain? Is there truly France? Is there truly, you know, Russia, China, all these things back there? Or are those just more regions that are more homogenized in the future than they are now?
So if you want to know about Terra, well, the Terran system in the BattleTech setting, best book I can direct you towards is Jihad Hotspots Terror, because okay. The first half deals with jihad era conflict. The second half of that source book really kind of delves into it, not just terror, but all the other kind of bodies in the system, and talks about their individual characteristics, the kind of people who live there. And it's very strange, because some of the societies, I don't know how else to express them, like the people who live out in the asteroid belts, almost doesn't feel like a Battletech setting. They're so far removed from the kind of feudalism of what else is going on in the setting. And they have incredibly advanced technology, and they're just quite content to do their own little thing. And they're not playing any part in Comstar, any of their games. And for the most part, they're left alone. And that there's so many little stories like that. It's a great source book. In terms of borders, as far as I know, Earth is divided into, I think they're just called administrative regions. Now, when I made my video on the battle for Terra, I made a very conscious decision that I was going to use maps that had no borders on them, no modern day borders. And similarly, not the borders as presented in the Battle for Terra source book, because they're all over the place. Sometimes they're like modern day borders. Sometimes they're just an amalgamation of smaller states just mushed together. And I just think back to all kind of post-World War I, World War II, where all these things were kind of, you know, divided up and shoved together to create larger blocks without any real consideration for the kind of people that are living there. And I was like, that's a can of worms I don't want to go into. So they're definitely still exist, if not an administrative region, at least in kind of the minds of the people who live there. There is a certain amount of kind of nationalism in these regions. But yeah, whether the nation states as they exist in our current era don't exist so much in Battletech. And then Comstar, of course, comes on the scene after the Starlink falls down. And they kind of take pretty much full control of the planet. And
how do you do, fellow Terrans?
The people in Terra are quite happy with that change as well. They're like, enough of this shite. We're quite content for Comstar to take us over. They know roughly what they're doing. They're keeping us out of all the bollocks that's going on beyond our borders. Yeah, fine. We're happy with this.
And I'm like you, Sven, in terms of, you know, I'm around kind of early to mid 3050s in terms of the core of my lore knowledge. And so I don't know what's happening in, you know, the Ilkhan era, but, you know, at least in that time frame, kind of around Tukiyat and before, is Earth essentially kind of a practical utopia, kind of insulated from war, you know, when Comstar is at its height? You know, is it just, do you know of internal conflicts there that are happening, or is it just everybody blissfully?
There's surely got to be some, but I think you're right. I don't think they've ever really kind of delved into that topic. Okay. I would make it clear that Comstar is such a tiny percentage of the people who live on Terra in kind of Succession Wars era. And for the most part, 99% of the people have no interest in what's going on outside. They're aware of just how bad things have been these last couple centuries, and they just want nothing to do with it. And it's not like Comstar is, you know, can rally all 6 billion people, however many there is, 12 billion people, I can't remember the number, behind them and like raise an army after that. Most people would just roll their eyes if kind of Comstar came around and tried to draft them into a force. But yeah, I don't know exactly how much of a utopia it is. I think obviously they've been shielded from some of the worst aspects of the Succession Wars. Mm-hmm. But I can't think of any specific kind of conflicts between people. Surely there's got to be some, because you hear about I can't name the planets, but there's definitely some out there in the inner sphere where one planet is colonized by one group, one nation of people, and then the neighboring planet will be colonized by another. I mean, I'll just randomly pick India and Pakistan, for example. I can't think of those as actual planets, but let's just use them as an example. And the kind of grudges and dislike that exists in this current era is talked about between those two planets. They will, you know, influence their relationship with each other. But in terms of what's actually going on with their home nations on Earth, I can't think of any examples of fighting going on there. And again, that just might be my ignorance of events later in the timeline, so I don't want to say that categorically. But I think, if not in a utopia, it's certainly one of the better places to be living, at least until World of Blake shows up.
I think it's kind of like Rome, where for generations and generations and generations, all this richness and booty flows toward it. And then inevitably, because of that, it becomes this huge center of import. It becomes this huge center of technology and learning and science and advancements. And then that happens so much, it becomes fought over. And then everyone leaves. And then it's left alone with that. And so it's kind of like Rome after multiple sackings. Does that mean it's a irradiated nuclear wasteland? No, nukes don't take that long to go away unless you use all of them known to man in one place. And so with very advanced technology and enough time to recover, Rome lives. And it's one of those things where if you look at the center of old empires, whether it be Rome, Constantinople, you find that time moves on. People are people. Flags go up, flags go down. But someone pays taxes to somebody. Somebody's in charge. And people live there. And if people live there, they will continue their culture. They may pick up new and important new culture from things that pass by. But living in a relatively peaceful bubble for long enough does promote a lot of advances, but it also holds people back. They stagnate a bit. They start to lose contact with people. And I agree with you when you say it would be very hard for Comstar in certain parts of this to ever go like, all right, y'all, we all need to go do something. Why? It's Earth. People come there. That's been their whole history. No, if it's important, it'll come to us. That is kind of a cultural history of Terra. They are not really out there to conquer anything. They're like, well, there was a Star League and we're not so big into that anymore. They've had their time. If you look at the hegemony, limited growth, mainly because the pushing against the other successor states, but they've largely had all of that burned out of them. And so it's kind of like the Shire in that sense, where it's like, don't need no adventures, just sit back and, you know, mind your farm. And enough generations of peace will make people stop really thinking about, well, what if? Well, what if? Well, what if? And we also have to ask ourselves, what information is allowed to flow to them? I think Comstar keeps a lot of places very idyllic and quiet. I think that they do filter a lot of information. And when they have worlds to them that are very precious for whatever reason, I think they keep them very happy, very much in the dark, and very compliant through just making sure that, hey, don't worry about outside. We're in charge and we love you. We're your friend. You have no choice. I didn't say that last part, but you know what I mean.
So if you had a place to live in the Inner Sphere, you know, 31st, early 31st century, where would it be? Where's the best place to live?
If you're just a random commoner, it's got to be Lyran Commonwealth. You've got the best odds of making something of your life there. If you're living in the Draconis Combine, you're completely subservient to warrior class. So great. If you want to go fight in a war, good on you. You'll maybe get somewhere, but more likely you're just going to get churned up in the infantry or stomped on by their own mechs because they don't give a damn about you. Lyran Commonwealth, you've got relatively decent rights. Of course, like each individual planet's got their own system of governance. So there's some, like in the Free Worlds League, especially, it's particularly varied. Some of them are like religious communes. Some of them are complete dictatorships. Some of them have a more democratic system, at least on a planetary scale. So it is a bit of a roll of the dice. You don't particularly want to be in the clan and invasion path. But even then, you know what? Could be there are worse places to be. Along the borders between the successor states is just about the most awful place you could live in the Inner Sphere, particularly in the era of the early succession wars, because there's a good chance you're going to be reduced to ash not long into the fighting.
So with all your experience kind of reading through BattleTech and, you know, and beyond tech, certainly yours kind of extends well beyond, what would be kind of your, and this will be a deep question, what would be kind of your best projection of what society and government should look like at kind of each stage of expansion into space. And so what, you know, based on everything you've read, what is the like most functional planetary government structure? What is the most functional government structure when you start to get to neighboring solar systems? And then what is the most functional when you get beyond that, when you get to kind of maybe hegemony size or house state size or even the whole inner sphere size? Because, you know, and I brought this up before with you, Tex, because I'm fascinated by it, of how the necessity for a return to a form of feudal society and governance happens when you breach the kind of the borders of instant communication. And so, you know, based on your studies of history and certainly of kind of the fictional universes, where do you think the border lines are for each type of government, like ideal government type?
Yeah, I mean, coming at it from like a meta perspective, everything is written by FASA, by CGL, to support the idea that feudalism, at least the way it exists in the inner sphere.
Well, I mean, like, I mean, just like it, in our history, like our true history, like as over the, if humanity, if, you know, Elon Musk has his vision and humanity is starting to explore, and, you know, I doubt we're going to be folding time, space, time, but, you know, if we could, you know, what, based on what you've learned, what do you think is the most functional in that real world environment of what we should pursue?
I'll let you answer that one, Tex. I don't even know where to begin on that.
Well, okay. I understand why feudalism is there. It's because FTL communication doesn't exist for a time, and then it does. But by the time it comes in, tradition, things have changed. So once things become entrenched, it's very hard to, you know, let it by. Imagine if your bank tomorrow told you, you cannot pay for things with money anymore. You have to sing to get something. You have to go out there and sing your heart out. I'm going to be poor as fuck. I cannot sing. This voice is not made for it. But the thing is that
I could see you with a part in like Misty Mountains.
God, just sitting there like things did suck in the Misty Mountains. But look, the thing is if you get out there and you have to establish a sense of command and control, you would have to appoint in some level or another planetary governors, much like Dune. You would probably have a fief system and allow each person to develop those resources as best they could. And if they did a bad job, you would replace them kind of like a giant corporation. It would be like the East Indies Trading Company. You would say, this is your port. Your job is to make this profitable. There can be no riots. There can be no insurrection. There can be none of these things that tear down the system of rule. And so long as you give the right percentages to the boss, all is well. And you would have some sort of, you know, hegemonic buy-in, I believe, would be mandatory, because expanding your capability across planets is going to be slow going. You can't just dump a bunch of technology and nerds on a planet and be like, all right, in 10 years, you owe me 10 battleships. It doesn't work like that. You cannot vertically, industrially integrate like Supreme Commander. You cannot in 45 minutes build an ocean of battleships and nuclear bombers. You would need to work for centuries. So you would need a plan that could successively be carried out by future generations, whether those are corporate board of administrators or feudal lords or some sort of collective ruling ideology or, you know, successive democratic regimes, whichever it may be. But there would have to be a checksum in the form of a large and cohesive ruling body between the planets, whether it be a Congress, again, corporate board or collective ruling strategy or an AI overlord or whatever. But you would have to manage so many fucking things that eventually I think it would probably come down to hand out some planetary governors and they have 20 years to make shit right. And if at any point, like a successive three quarters results in extreme negative impact that involves the wrath of the higher authority, change and replaced instantly. It's probably a bit more like Traveler in that sense. I could see a lot more self-determination and definitely a much freer hand in rulership at a planetary level. Because if you have a planet where a lot of people come because of purported religious significance or spiritual significance, maybe not the best place to build a bunch of arms industry. Because these people will say, well, that's against my religious beliefs, or I don't think we should be doing this, or blah, blah, blah. However, that could be an amazing planet for medical advances. And you can't force every planet to be a weapons factory. You cannot force every planet to build food or food-producing facilities to export off-world. What if you go to a planet that's extremely arid, like Dune, but they have a lot of petrochemicals because they have a bunch of dried-up ancient oceans? Well, you should probably have that planet cracking hydrocarbons 24/7 and not, you know, exporting box lunches. It's hard to grow stuff in sand. You would have to import a lot of resources. The other thing would be the management of these resources. Some of your worlds are going to be very hard to live on, but produce rare earth alloys that are going to produce, you know, germanium and all of this amazing shit out there. All of this amazing, positively impactful industrial resources. But you're still going to need to truck this to another planet to turn steel into ball bearings. You're going to still need to move these things around. And that is going to require a lot of effort as well. Labor force. You're going to have planets that are vastly overpopulated because they are planet-sized ecumenopolises. And they have a lot of jobs that are desk jobs, not a lot of outdoor jobs on that planet. And people get fed up with it. I don't want to live in a box. I don't want to live in the Kowloon walled city. I don't want to sit there and work 16 hours a day. So guess what? You could say, well, we have some openings on these planets. You want to go work on a water world? You want to like fish and like punch sharks in the tits that are like 300 feet long? Or do you want to like go be a farmer? Or do you want to go work in this giant weapons factory on, you know, Hellscape 9? What do you like? Just go ahead and choose. It would require a lot of care to not only build this wide variety of industries required to sustain growth or even sustain the development of worlds, because significant industrial development on a reasonable timeline is going to require a shitload of workers and a shitload of resources. Go look to any city that's going through the pains of urban renewal right now. You can't just truck in 100,000 workers and say, fix everything. You have to figure out how to make that happen. You can't just go into a place and go, all right, everybody, diversify your industry. How? If you don't have the schools there and you don't have the means there, you can't just tell people, okay, learn to code. Well, this is a mining planet. Everyone here mines. Everyone came here for mining. All we have is mining equipment. You're going to have to really control those resources, which would require, again, a larger polity and more haphazardly. If you put all those people out there in space and you don't try to control it all under one flag, somebody's gonna. Inevitably, somebody's gonna come along and go, you know what? I'm tired of all this shit. And I'm tired of these people and those people and that and this and that. And they're gonna unify it. So you have to have a unifying philosophy, idea, cause, or drive that people can get on board with. Humanity, fuck yeah, is a really good one. I hope that that is the one we carry into space and not like, you know, this planet brought to you by Starbucks, because that's going to be grim.
Ben, in doing all your research, what do you find is kind of like one of the most underutilized resources for the BattleTech community? You know, as tools, as a gaming implement, as a source of knowledge, you know, is there anything out there that you find has really been a gold mine for you that you feel like people should be aware of?
I mean, sun is the obvious thing to point to, but I mean, everyone's aware of that. Let's see, I'm trying to go through all my resources now. What were my bookmarks? No, I mean, in terms of kind of research, yeah, I mean, I haven't really got an answer beyond Sana for that one. There are some things that Sana, I mean, it's an excellent, excellent resource. But then there are some times where, you know, the specifics of who wrote it can heavily influence the way or the idea you get that might not be exactly accurate to how things went down. But I think it's just a fantastic place where I've just gone to spend a lot of time there doing reading. There's not really much beyond that that I can think of.
I would definitely say Sarna. From some of my earliest videos, I've been praising them as a wiki because, you know, I believe my line was, hey, it's not like Wikipedia. They don't have like 10,000 page entry for water. Everything there is fairly fucking relevant. They've done amazing jobs in terms of collecting all the resources and presenting them. I love their map work project. Their map work project year by year, where things are, how many jumps, how far away. They also are excellent at citing sources. A lot of wikis are not good at citing sources. They'll just go, it's in a comic, or it wasn't a scene in a movie. And you're like, this is a really shit fan community to just write stuff like that. Sarna doesn't do that. They go, subtext one, go down to the bottom of the page. Here is the book. Here is the page. Here is the year. You can find out where things are stated. It will clearly define where things are apocryphal or not. And it has differing opinions. They talk a lot about stuff. Sarna has an excellent staff that presents things in an excellent way in terms of getting your feet wet with basic resources. I would say, of course, the primary resource in any research done into this setting should not be Sarna, but the actual book itself. I know that a lot of people write things in various ways. Sarna is a great secondary source, and it does all of its citations and points back to the original sources. I would encourage anyone who's just curious to certainly go read Sarna and then go read the original source material that really excites you, because you may find your own lenses and perceptions and biases give you different insights. Another one is the master unit list. When you start getting into the nitty gritty of what mechs have what, by what year, who made buy, how many guns, master unit list is amazing. Because you can sit there and stat all your mechs out on cards, which I've done several times. You'll see the little cards I present in Battletech, and I still make errors because it's a lot to go over. But the master unit list is great because you'll sit there and go, why is this mech that way? And then you can build it on that card and go play it and go, oh, I get what this is for now. And they give you just the raw data there. So the master unit list I like. One of the best resources you'll find as well is other fans. A lot of people out there have a lot of knowledge and have been around for a lot longer than I, you, or hell, all of us combined have. And if you listen to a lot of the fans who love this setting, they will give you insight into things and say, oh yeah, well, this was written after these historical events, and this was kind of a nod to it. You go, oh shit. Okay. I didn't see that parallel. A lot of these people who are the older generation of Battletech fans, which I'm very barely borderline on, there's one generation before me, and those are the people who are around since Battle Droids. But just talking with people like, you know, Tunt Davion, who's been playing the game constantly for over 30 fucking years, has a lot more insight into how mechs work than somebody who just started playing MechWarrior 5 a few years ago. They have a lot of insight through editions of rule books and how the battles actually play out in tabletop. He knows everything in terms of that shit. And running into people who are such passionate and driven fans who breathe this stuff, not just casually dip their toes in now and then, or YouTubers like us who dabble in these resources, people who have lived this world through, regardless of whatever company has held the rights, through WizKids, Clicky Tech, and all that other stuff, who love it and keep it alive and have kept that light alive, their insight is fundamentally necessary. And I think it's necessary to hear those voices. You must always hear them.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Tex on that one. When I think about how many hundreds of hours of reading I've put in, and just what a tiny fraction I know compared to some people out there, you know, it's really important. Or there's just so many knowledgeable people in the community. And you're asking about good resources. Well, Sarna came up. I think it's worth pointing people towards the Sarna Discord as well. It's a place where I've been several times, you know, to ask for clarification on things. And yeah, like you say, people who've been around, lived and breathed it since the 80s, It's incredible the kind of depth of knowledge they've got. And they just seem to be able to just draw this out of their mind, like obscure details.
Absolutely. Just so many people helped me with the Charger episode because I started asking people I knew who played the shit out of the game forever. I said, everyone says the Charger is just a shit mech and it's bad. And, meh. And every single one of those people smiled like somebody on payday and goes, let me tell you a story, brother. And they start telling a story of some Macho Man shit where someone does the flying elbow and drop kick someone with a mech. Those are Charger stories. That's what inspired me as well to continue writing that. I had a lot of second guesses about maybe it is as bad as people say. Maybe it is just kind of a throwaway watchword. But then I realized, well, why are these people whipping people's asses with it? And I realized that, you know, sure, there are some imperfect weapons out there in this world. There's some stuff that may be old or not as high tech or not as great, but then you go see a war breakout and, well, shit, that shit works just fine. Then you wonder, why do people have a negative opinion over things? And you have to look at through what lenses they're viewing things. And again, the Charger is not the greatest mech in the world, but 80 tons slapping the shit out of you is incredibly impactful. That is a lot of ass whipping. And if you're playing in games where melee is, you know, secondary and a last ditch thing or not even possible, then you're not going to think much of it. But if you play tabletop and you've got a little bit of, you know, I'm the cream of the crop and I'm going to rise to the top, and you get in there and start doing Macho Man stuff, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And you realize in Battletech, you can rip parts off of mechs and then beat people to death with their own mech. That is what the Charger's for. There are mechs that are built for just going toe to toe in the squared circle. And you need to have that sort of lens that, yes, there's very imperfect tools. Sure, you can pick a lock with an automated lock picker and you can sit there with a stethoscope on and listen to all the locks and pins, or you can sledgehammer the deadbolt through the door. Both work. Both work. One is certainly a lot louder and a lot more crude, but both work.
What I love about the Charger is the debate's been going on since 86 when it was introduced, because you can go back and read like the old, or something I've been going through is the Battle Technology magazines, and the Charger comes up in multiple times throughout them, people debating its use and whether it is just the biggest heap of junk or whether it actually serves its purpose well. And it's funny to me that for 35 years, people are still arguing about this specific mech, about whether it is of any good.
Again, that's why I love Battletech, because shit, we can have these debates. It's not just like this is the bad and this is the good. It's you can bring a lot of lenses to stuff. You can say that you like or dislike something for 100 reasons in Battletech, and it's all valid. It's all valid.
So Sven, you've been in the game for a year now and with regard to Battletech and Techs for several years beyond that. What would you like to see as fans and content creators from the IP owners, you know, be it, you know, in our case, more CGL, for other cases, it might be more, you know, PGI or HBS. What do you think that those IP holders could do to better support the content creator community?
Oh, I think they've been doing a very good job. I've seen them shout out a number of good channels lately in the Mercenaries Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. In terms of supporting community, I'm not sure what much more they could do. I mean, they're providing us with the content, so yeah.
I have one thing I would say. Community outreach is diabolically hard. It is diabolically hard. It is diabolically hard. I've not yet found many corporations who are peerless at it, because it's hard to reach everybody. And that's okay. It is diabolically hard. So I'm not going to say go this or anti that or what have you. I'm just saying never give up. Never give up trying to reach your fans. Never give up trying to engage with meaningful dialogue with what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. Most companies fail at the point where they say, I know what's good for people. I know what they want. Instead of asking and listening, what do people want? That is usually the tipping point for any corporation. If you want to go see how this works out, there's a wonderful documentary on World of Darkness that covers how World of Darkness as a corporation had its incredible meteoric rise and then collapsed. It's a fantastic documentary. And one of the things that becomes very, very apparent was at a certain point, they stopped listening to the fans and they just started saying, well, this is what people want. And they were wrong. You have to always engage that. But I have one thing I will beg. Harebrained schemes. If you can hear the sound of my voice, I ask kindly, on bended knee, with great reverence and humility, please make another game. That's it. Doesn't have to be right now. Doesn't have to be tomorrow. Doesn't even have to be this decade. But please, please make another game. Because BattleTech 2018 sparked such joy in me when I first started playing it. And I still play it today. I am not a person who plays a lot of games for a long time. I'm not that kind of person. I find a lot of games are overhyped nonsense. I find a lot of games are boring shit. I find a lot of games are paper thin. I find a lot of games are compromised, where they promise 10 million things and deliver one thing and then pay a lot for advertising and walk away. HBS BattleTech, harebrained schemes. Please give us another game. Do it again. Just give us a little bit more polish and a little bit more content, and you'll do fine. You don't have to do four times as good. You don't have to do four times as big. You don't have to rewrite the whole universe. You don't, nothing. I'm not asking for a damn thing other than just one more, please. One more helping of that would certainly make me feel so much better in the BattleTech world. That is what I want. Harebrained schemes. I am asking very kindly. Please and thank you.
Yeah, I think that's been a gateway drug for so many people coming into the community. That specific game, a friend of mine picked it up earlier this year when it was on sale. Had never played any BattleTech content before. And since then, in the last 3 months or so, they've got over 30 models now because they just so fell in love with the universe. And now they've it opened the door to collecting the miniatures as well. There's a whole other side of the hobby. So yeah, it's definitely one I'm sure a lot of people would love to see another part in it.
And what, even Sven, if it's what are you?
Oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah, what are your vectors into BattleTech? You know, is it video games, tabletop, just the lore? Like, how do you explore this universe as a fan?
So I've never ever played the tabletop side of things, and it's not that I wouldn't. It's just simply a matter of time. I know I wouldn't want to get the miniatures and then not paint them, and like in order to it's just such a time investment, and it's so limited that it's just. I've told myself I'm not going to go down that path because I know once it starts, it'll just take over. And before I know it, I've got several regiments of them all lined up on shelves. So for me, the way I got into the universe, into BattleTech, was a long drawn out process over decades, actually. But way back in the 90s, when I was just a wee kid, that got taken to supermarket and they had... you go and sit in the entertainment aisle and like look at all the games that you were never going to own. And there it was, Mech Commander Gold. And yeah, pick that up. And that was my introduction to the universe. And I'd never heard of BattleTech at that point. Some point over the next few years, I had heard of, Mech Assault, Mech Warrior, but I really didn't realize just how much of a universe there was beyond those. And I can remember, I think it was circa 2016 or so. At some point, I went looking for more information, like some BattleTech wiki. Or no, I didn't even know BattleTech existed yet, and ended up on Sarna. And I was like, what is Sarna? What is this? And like, this must be something else, because clearly this is not the thing that I'm after. But I think at the time, like the featured article was the Raven, which was something I recognized. And back then, I think I was like a fan of other science fiction like Mass Effect, Halo, and had spent a fair amount of hours going through their wikis And I can remember, like, I think Halopedia at the time had, I don't know, 3,000-4,000 articles, Mass Effect Wiki maybe 1,200 or so. And Sarna had like 12,000. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? How have I never heard of this thing before? And I think that's what drew me to the universe, was just the sheer scope of it. And then, yeah, just to my horror, discovering how many novels there are, I think it's well over 100 at this point. And it feels like when the Humble Bundle came around a month ago, I obviously picked that up. And I kind of course, first thing I do is put them all in a spreadsheet, and then, you know, into their order. So, and then I'm gradually ticking them off as I go through them. And it just made me realize how little, I've barely dipped my toe in the ocean that is BattleTech. So yeah, I am into the lore and the novel side of things, and the video games as well. Though truthfully, I haven't played any of the newer ones. Yeah, and not tabletop myself. Not that I would be opposed to it, like I say, but just that's, yeah, time's not there.
Well, I think I had one of those did we just become best friends moments listening to you there, because I had Halo, Mass Effect, and BattleTech are my three. Well, and Star Wars, but that's not really a game. Though I did play X-Wing, but Mass Effect. I would play that, you know, every week if it wouldn't basically end all other interactions in my life.
I think you're going to need to start up a second podcast right now so we can talk the next 2 hours about Mass Effect.
Dude, let's do it.
I think it's a little bit off topic, but like, yeah. I feel like once we start going there, like, yeah, we're going to just continue for hours.
Well, I'll do it just for fun. I'm always tempted to be like, should I like add non-BattleTech stuff to Renegade HPG? And I'm like, no, I'll stay true. I'll keep in my niche. And but that's not to say I don't have 5 YouTube channels. You know,
that kind of reminds me. A week ago in the grocery store, I saw a guy who had one of those N7, you know, Alliance hoodies.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I passed him, and he nodded at me, and he's like, "Hey," and I said, "Shepherd," and just kept walking. and he was like, "What?"
That was awesome. Perfect impression as well. Just one word, but it was like quintessential Rex quote.
It's my favorite. It's my favorite impersonation. It doesn't require much effort.
That's awesome. Very good. Well, let's wrap there, guys. This was a very fun conversation. Actually, I'll get Tex. Is there anything you wanted to ask? Any kind of something of a spin that I might have missed that as a fellow creator and lore man?
I have one thing I just want to encourage you. One thing. Never, ever stop. No matter what you suffer, no matter what you go through, no matter how much you hurt, never stop creating shit. You're relatively new at this. And I mean when I say that we're all in this together, and I am but a humble and weak and weary voice in the choir. But never stop creating. Always find new things that inspire you. Have friends that pick you up when you're down. But never, ever stop. That is what I just want to champion your cause. I very much like your work. I think that you are a talent, and you are certainly something worth of lauding or tribute. But please, please, sir, never stop creating. YouTube sucks. The wins are unfair. The clicks are nonsense. Everything is made up. Regardless, never stop.
Thank you for those kind words, Tex. I would pick that up and continue it, though. I'd say if there are people listening to this right now who thought about making their own YouTube stuff, it is a fantastic creative outlet. And just like Tex says, yeah, sometimes it's totally random what goes on behind the scenes.
Oh, God,
completely arbitrary. But you don't need that. What I realize, I used to watch a few smaller channels, and they only had about like 400-500 subscribers. But I realized just in participating in that kind of little community, just how much fun it can be to have a small channel. And the fact that mine's grown to the size it has is kind of still kind of absurd to me. But you don't need, you know, a million views to have fun with it. You know, it can be just tremendous joy just interacting with that core little audience.
Absolutely.
I would recommend it to people. Give it
absolutely.
A go. And I think both of us always would be happy to see more people in the community creating things.
I want to see so many more voices in this community. It's like I've seen people start to emerge that are amazing, where you have like DJ Jason Sky, who is doing like BattleTech Vaporwave remixes. And
oh,
shit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, that is excellent. I think that that is what I want to see. I want to see people out there tearing and stitching this place up and making it theirs. I've seen so many insane, cursed, blurst, and wonderful things out of this community, from the 100-ton urban mech to the Irby Lamb to, I mean, I've seen so many beautiful things made by people, and I want to see more. I want to see 100 times more, because that is the gift of the BattleTech community, is that anybody can come along and make something that fits in this universe and make it theirs and make it beautiful. And it will inspire more people to do the same. And that is exactly what we need. We need more.
Yeah. It's such a big, expansive universe that there's so many, you know, the two of us could make videos for the rest of our lives on it. And we barely scratch the surface. There's so many little niches and stories that could be told. There's plenty of space for new people to join the scene, so to speak. And I see new names emerging constantly.
Totally. Yeah, the Bungle Tech guys are just hopping in on the podcast scene. And there are always new YouTubes popping up. I love, you know, beyond just BattleTech, but whenever I find a video that's just exceptional video, and then I see someone that they only have like 300 subscribers, I'm like, oh, well, you know, I don't comment enough. I think that my advice to the fans out there is definitely, when you see something you like, say something nice, because it does really help. But whenever I see great content, and then I'm like, wow, this person just started, I'm always like, you know, sure to kind of comment, be like, this is amazing, keep it up. YouTube is a interesting property. I'm hoping, I'm optimistic that Twitter might be able to kind of replace some of it. Their subscription model seems to be very good for the creators and good support, and maybe like early YouTube levels of kind of support and return of incomes there. So fingers crossed, but I think people need to embrace Twitter as an alternative before that happens, but we'll see. Time will tell. Well, gentlemen, thank you again. Tex, thanks for coming on as my wingman here. And Sven, thank you. Thank you for all your work in the community. Thanks for, you know, providing this entertainment for me as well as for everyone else. And thanks for chatting about it today. It's been fun.
Thank you for inviting me on. It's been real good to chat to both of you.
All right. And thank you very much. It was my honor, and I appreciate it. I deeply do.
All right. Take care, everybody. This is Renegade HP signing off, and we'll catch you next time.